Now, there are those who claim that the whole distinction is a mistake. There really is no difference between what people call selfish behavior and what people call altruistic behavior, or motivations, or character. True, we do make these distinctions, and we do agree upon them, but it's all based on mistake. It's all a mistake in analysis. If we would understand the situation correctly, we would see that all behavior is really selfish. This is a surprising position. To take what is essentially the whole of as far as I know, the whole of mankind, or certainly the vast, vast majority, who make these distinctions, and to claim that the entire behavior is based on mistake, it's certainly possible, but he who would undermine such universal and stable, agreed upon practice, owes us some kind of good reason. But what I want to do tonight is look at the reason that is given, and then to hopefully accomplish two things. Number one, to show that the reason is not a good reason. And if I show the reason for thinking all behavior is selfish is not a good reason, what follows at that stage of the argument is that we don't know whether it's all selfish or not. It still could be all selfish, just that what was proposed as a reason for thinking so will turn out not to be a reason. And then I will present you with a reason for thinking that the position's mistake, that actually there is such a thing as genuine altruistic behavior. So, we have three stages. Let's start with the reason for thinking that all behavior really is selfish.
A reaction that a person takes helps to create the kind of person that that person is. Like, every action builds upon that person's character.
Right.
So therefore, no matter whether the action was intended to be selfless, it still defies the self.
Okay. Does that mean that it's selfish?
Well, it doesn't mean that it's selfish, but what it means is that there is no such thing as a selfless act.
Oh, I'm sorry. I see. That term could be understood. I don't mean an act without a self. I mean an act not done by a self or not related to a self. I meant an act not done for the sake of benefiting the self. You're right. Obviously, when you act, the act comes out of yourself and it has an impact on yourself. I didn't mean that you're dealing with a robot here that has no self and is acting. I didn't mean that. What I meant was that it's an act. Not every action is undertaken in order to benefit the self. That's what I'm aiming at. Well, let's call the person who thinks that everything is selfish the cynic. Let's start with the cynic's argument. Now, I'm going to try to do the best I can for the cynic. Some may feel they can do better for him, and so I'll be glad to hear it. The cynic says, listen, you believe in altruism, you give me your best case of altruism, and I'll show you that even in your best case, it's really selfish. And of course, if I can show you in your best case that it's selfish, then it follows for all the other cases, but they're also selfish. So I say, okay, here's my best case. It's January 3rd in Chicago, and the wind chill is minus 22 degrees, and it's sleet. And I'm driving down the highway, and there's a guy parked at the side with a white handkerchief on his radio antenna. And they don't do that anymore because they think you'll, shoot him up or steal a car. But I come from a generation where we actually help people, they put up a sign, people stop and help them. So I'm driving, I see this fellow parked by the side, and I think to myself, I happen to be an expert mechanic. Could be that I could help him. If he waits for the tow truck to come, he's going to freeze. But I have an appointment, and it's sleeting outside, and I know. So I struggle. I pull over. I say to him, what's the matter? Won't turn over. Open up the hood. I stand out there and I jiggle with the wires for 15 minutes. And I say, try it again. Bang. Turns on. Close the hood. My license plate is covered with sleet. You can't read it. I say goodbye. He doesn't know who I am. I don't know who he is. We'll never see each other again. I drive off thinking to myself, what's that? I helped him. I got cold and wet. I'm delayed for my appointment. I didn't make any money out of it. I'm not going to get a paper in return out of it. There I am. I did something altruistic. The cynic says, look again. Look a little more deeply. How did you feel when you drove off after helping him fix the car? I say, well, actually, I felt pretty good. I mean, you know, I felt satisfied and happy and felt there was a certain pleasure that I had. Right, says the cynic. And now ask yourself, how would you have felt if you had passed him by, if you'd made the opposite decision? So I say, well, I know myself. It would have hurt. You know, my conscience would have bothered me, and then I had trouble getting to sleep at night. And, you know. So the cynic says, well, you see, what you did by stopping and helping him is you caused yourself a pleasure and you avoided a pain. Helping the guy with his car, says the cynic, is no different from buying an ice cream cone. You buy an ice cream cone because you're hungry, because you're thirsty, because you're hot, because you want something sweet. If you don't buy it, you suffer a certain frustration. If you buy it, you get a certain pleasure. Here, if you hadn't helped him, you would have suffered a certain pain, frustration. Having helped him, you got a certain pleasure. If you agree that buying the ice cream cone is selfish, then certainly, since helping the fellow with the automobile has exactly the same effects, it's just as selfish. That's the cynic's argument. And since, he says, you constructed your automobile case to be your best case, and I've shown you that even in that case, it's selfish, you ought to conclude that in all other cases, it's certainly selfish. That, as I understand it, is the cynic's argument. You with me so far? Okay, now, this argument is simply based on a mistake. The cynic has confused items that accompany an action with the purpose of the action. What the cynic has shown, and although there are those who debate this, I'm inclined to agree. Whenever you undertake an action and you succeed in doing what you wanted to do, you will gain a pleasure. But, for all the cynic has shown us, the pleasure that you gain is merely an effect of succeeding at the action. Nothing he has said indicates that getting the pleasure was the purpose of the action, the goal of the action. Here are two analogies to make the distinction between an accompaniment and the goal clear. Consider George. He lives in Sacramento, California. About 4 years ago, the Mississippi River disastrously overflowed in the Midwest. He's watching this on television, and he sees the progress of the river down from north to south, and he thinks, that's terrible, these people are suffering. And he sees that further down, they're picking up sandbags and creating sandbag banks, which will either will or will not hold back the river. And he says, I can't stand it, I'm going to help. He drives 36 hours straight to a city down the river, and he spends 2 days hauling sandbags up onto the sandbag wall. Then he goes home. 2 months later, he's recounting his experience to one of his friends. And one of his friends says to him, you spent 2 days hauling sandbags? Yeah. Tell me something. That's considerable exercise, isn't it? Oh, you bet. Boy, was I exhausted. Well, tell me something. Do you think that you increased your muscular strength hauling those sandbags? So he says, well, I guess so. I mean, I guess that's what exercise does. And that's what it usually does. So then the fellow says, well then, that's why you went. You went in order to increase your muscular strength. I hope that's patently absurd. He didn't even think of it. It didn't occur to him until the fellow pointed it out 2 months later. And said it was no part of the purpose of his action, even though it was an inevitable consequence, an inevitable beneficial consequence of the action. That doesn't make it the purpose of the action. Second example, a little closer to home, every action expends energy. Rarely is it the purpose of the action to expend energy, except when you're overweight, you want to lose some weight, so you're going to do something to burn off calories. But rarely is that even part of the purpose of the action, even though it's an inevitable consequence of the action. Now, an altruist is a person, or altruistic action, or altruistic motivation, is one where the goal is to help other people. To point out that no matter what you do, if you're successful, you'll get a pleasure, says nothing about what your goal is. It might be to get the pleasure, it might not be to get the pleasure. So far, just pointing out that it accompanies the action says nothing about that. And since it says nothing about that, it says nothing about whether or not the actions are altruistic. It's just a confusion between an accompaniment on the one hand and the goal on the other hand. Similarly, people will say, you did it because you wanted to. You did it because you desired to do it. That might be right. Although people question it, but I'm inclined to think it is right. The question it doesn't ask is where desires come from. But we'll come to that in a little bit. I'm not making that point at the moment. Yes, I did it because I wanted to. But that doesn't tell me what it is I wanted. Sure, I did it because I wanted to. But what did I want in doing it? What was my goal in doing it? If you think of desire as a kind of catch-all for motivation, you can't do it unless you're motivated to do it. That's a truism. But that's not the issue. The issue is not, did I have a motivation to do it? Of course, if I did it, I must have had some motivation to do it. Question is, what was the motivation aiming at? And for all we've said so far, it might just as well have been aiming at somebody else's benefit. It might just as well have been altruistic. So I think that this argument in favor of selfishness of all actions and motivations is simply a mistake. It's confusing, an accompaniment or a byproduct. By the way, this is not me talking. Aristotle made the point 2,300 years ago, and more philosophers have made it consistently to the present day, that Aristotle says that happiness is only achieved when it's a byproduct of your actions. If you seek happiness, you won't find it. So that this argument is a mistake. And where we are so far, then, is we don't know whether all actions are selfish or not. We thought the cynic proposed a reason to think they are. Reason is wrong. So at this point, we should say we don't know. Now, if we say we don't know, then given what I said at the outset, that everybody naturally makes the distinction between selfish and altruistic actions, at this point, even if I said nothing else, it would be appropriate to continue the present practice because the challenge has failed. Questions up to you. Okay. That's the easy part. Now comes the hard part. I will try to do this clearly, but I find that I often cannot make it easy and simple to understand the idea. This argument now is due to Joseph Butler, a great British Anglican priest, and made considerable contributions to moral philosophy. And this is an argument which has been repeated endlessly in the last 200 years. This is now an argument that some motivations and some actions are indeed altruistic. Let's think for a minute about pleasure. There are different kinds of pleasure, different causes of pleasure. One type of pleasure is satisfaction. One type. Satisfaction means I want something. I get it. Satisfying the desire leads to pleasure. How exactly to say it is difficult. I'm not going to distinguish between those. Other pleasures have nothing to do with desire. You will someday, have children, and you'll have the experience of feeding an infant ice cream for the first time. Well, the infant is weary, and it's cold, and it's wet, and its consistency is unfamiliar, and it's usually quite cautious and quite suspicious until it gets the first taste. Hooked for life. Hooked for life. Because it's an instant pleasure having nothing to do with desire. No desire is relevant to the experience. But we are, so to speak, hardwired to feel pleasures on the basis of certain experiences. So there are these two different kinds of pleasures. Pleasure of satisfaction, where the pleasure exists because there was already a desire, and the desire was satisfied. And what you could call base pleasures, where a pre-existing desire is not necessary. Now, of course, if you have one of these base pleasures, and you experience it, you very well will, I would say it's almost inevitable, that you will form a desire for having that pleasure. In the future, that experience is a double. On the one hand, there's a base pleasure. On the other hand, there's the satisfaction of the desire for the pleasure, which is the second pleasure. So it gives you a double payoff. People who, you know, the child who tastes ice cream for the first time now wants more ice cream. When it gets more ice cream, it gets the base pleasure, and it also gets the satisfaction of the satisfying the desire for the ice cream. Now let's try to imagine a situation where, if there is pleasure available in the activity, the pleasure is a pleasure of satisfaction. There are no base pleasures. I don't mean base in a moral sense that they're nasty. I mean just basic. I don't say basic. There are no basic pleasures. Let's take an example like this. You have challenged your 6-year-old cousin to a game, or about 8-year-old cousin to a game of chess. Your purpose in so doing is to encourage him to play chess. Your plan is to lose the game to him. You know, to expose your pieces and sort of fall behind and then lose the game. Unfortunately, the cousin is so clumsy and he's so unaware of the pieces that you put your knight in clear danger, he doesn't notice it, and then he makes mistakes, and sometimes he says, "Oh, I left my queen open." So now, what are you going to do? Not take it? Then you expose your motivation. So reluctantly, you take piece after piece, and you end up winning the game. I think in that circumstance, there's no pleasure at all. There's no pleasure at all. Because winning a game against an 8-year-old opponent if you're normal, winning a game, unless this is not going to give you pleasure, and you fail at your goal. Suppose you had lost the game, then there wouldn't have been a pleasure. What pleasure? The pleasure of succeeding at my goal, of losing the game, and thereby hopefully encouraging to want to play chess. So if I had succeeded at my goal of losing the game, I would have had a pleasure, but the pleasure would have been the pleasure of satisfying this desire. It seems to me that in this project, the project of losing the game of chess to my 8-year-old cousin, the only pleasure that's available is the pleasure of satisfying a desire. If I didn't have the desire, there wouldn't be any pleasure. That's true even for the flip side of normal games of chess. Why is it that people enjoy winning games of chess? Where does the enjoyment come from? It's not like a warm bath. It's not like vanilla ice cream. It's that these people, for whatever reason, want to win games of chess. And when they win, they've satisfied that desire to win. And that's what gives them the pleasure. Take away the desire, and there's no pleasure in winning at all. So, what we've said so far is that there are at least these two different kinds of pleasures, basic pleasures and satisfactions. And there are circumstances in life where the only pleasure available is a pleasure of satisfaction. Are you with me so far? Okay. I've only got one more step to go. But when I take this next step, everybody feels as if I pulled out the rug and done something illegal. So let me repeat it again. This should be boring. I hope it's boring. But maybe it'll drive it home so that when I take the next step, it won't look like cheating. Here's the picture. First of all, you have the desire. See him? Here he is. Here's his beak. And here are his teeth. See? This is the desire that wants. What does it want? X. The desire is aimed at X. X is its object. X is what it is. X is a thing that can satisfy. Okay? Now, what happens is, you feed X to the desire, and the desire chops it up and swallows it, and the result is a pleasure. It's a two-step process. You feed X to the desire is step one, and the pleasure is step two. Right? Now, we're imagining a situation in which the only pleasure available is the pleasure of satisfaction. The only pleasure that's available is the one that's going to happen as a result of feeding X to the desire. There are no other pleasures in the picture. Okay? Alright, here we go. What then is X? Is X a pleasure? Could X be a pleasure? I see, I failed again. Nobody knows the answer. Well, let's try.
No.
But it could, why? Why do you say no?
Because the pleasure is a byproduct.
Because then you have two. Then you have two pleasures. You have X as a pleasure, and you have the byproduct of satisfying the desire as a pleasure. Then you have two different pleasures. And we started by saying, we're describing a situation in which there's only one pleasure available. The pleasure of satisfaction. So X can't be a pleasure. What is X? X is something that a person tries to accomplish, like winning a game of chess, or losing a game of chess, or the many other things that people get pleasure from because they have a desire to do it. And when they succeed in fulfilling the desire, they get the pleasure of satisfaction. Here, the desire comes first and the pleasure comes second. Pleasure is a result of satisfying the desire. Now, let's just try the knee-jerk response that you get when you present this, when I present it usually. Maybe it's an admirable successful, I don't know. And I say, no, you've made a mistake. What the desire is really aimed at is the pleasure of doing X. That's what the desire is for. What's desired is a pleasure. Everything you desire is pleasure. You only desire pleasure. I is X. The desire is a desire for the pleasure of doing X. According to this argument, that can't be. It can't be that when you analyze desire very carefully, you'll see that the desire is a desire for the pleasure of doing X. Because there is no pleasure in doing X. Except that it satisfies the desire to do X and the pleasure is a byproduct. The pleasure isn't there for the desire to desire. For the desire to be of or for the pleasure of doing X, the pleasure of doing X has to be independent. It has to be there like the taste of ice cream. In the case of ice cream, you have it. My desire to eat ice cream is a desire for the pleasure of the taste of the ice cream. It can be anyway. It doesn't have to, but it can be. So there, the ice cream tastes good without any desires. I learned that from experience. I form a desire for that pleasure. And then, my desire is for that pleasure. And then, as I said, you get a double payoff. You get the basic pleasure, and then you get the pleasure of satisfaction. But I'm describing cases in which there is only one pleasure, not two. There's a pleasure of satisfaction. If the only pleasure available is a pleasure of satisfaction, then the thing the desire is after can't be a pleasure. The pleasure only occurs as a byproduct. The pleasure isn't there beforehand, like the taste of ice cream. Now, if that's right, said Butler, then we have desires that are not desires for pleasure. Well, if we have desires that are not desires for pleasure, what then could they be desires for? Now I think the sky is open. Take a look at your psychology, honestly, without any preconceived notions, without defending any controversial theories, and ask yourself, what are the kinds of things that you desire? And you'll find a tremendous variety. You have selfish desires, desires for your own pleasure, advancement, honor, benefit. You have desires for other people's benefit. You have desires to hurt other people, vicious desires aimed at other people, desires for revenge, all sorts of desires. A person's psychology is very various. Desires come in many different types. No reason to assimilate them all to one type and say the only thing you desire is really your own pleasure or your own benefit. There's simply no reason to do that. Now, a desire for my benefit, where the goal of the desire is my benefit, is a selfish desire. An action that is based on satisfying that desire is a selfish action. A desire for someone else's downfall and hurt is a vicious desire. A desire for someone else's benefit will be an altruistic desire. Desires come in all different types. Therefore, motivations come in all different types. Actions come in all different types. And people come in all different types. Human psychology is very, very, in this respect. Yeah.
I don't know. If I'm doing an action, an altruistic action, helping someone, and at that time I'm feeling pleasure, it doesn't happen later. You're saying that because that's a byproduct, that doesn't really matter?
It doesn't matter for the definition of altruism. Let me explain a little bit more why people make this mistake. There's a piece of logic which is okay for itself, but then leads people to a wrong conclusion. People try to face the question this way. How could I prove that he did it not for pleasure? Well, if I could create a situation in which he did it and didn't get any pleasure, that would surely prove he didn't do it for pleasure. I mean, if he knew what he was doing and he understood what the consequences would be. So this would be the knockdown case in favor of altruism. Create a case where a person does something, succeeds in doing it, doesn't get any pleasure at all. And it's true, if you had such a case, it would be a knockdown case for altruism. I think that's impossible. I think it's impossible. But from the fact that the knockdown case doesn't work, it doesn't follow that the position is wrong. It could be right for other reasons. So people make this mistake. The mistake I avoided on the opposite foot 12 minutes ago. People make this mistake. The altruist is putting forward an argument. The argument is there are cases of action without any pleasure at all. That's a mistake. Correct. So altruism is wrong. Incorrect. That's just an argument for altruism which failed. I'm presenting a different argument, or Butler is presenting a different argument in favor of altruism as a possibility. So the idea that you get pleasure is part and parcel of altruism. The altruist will get pleasure in performing his action. Because whenever you succeed in doing what you set out to do, you get the pleasure of satisfying the desire to do what you did. So altruism need not imply, take it to imply, that you don't get any pleasure in the action. Only the pleasure that you get in the action was not the goal of the action. That wasn't the purpose of the action.
Is Butler's argument to say that your desire doesn't have to be pleasure, it's not pleasurable, it's just a desire in and of itself?
No. So, satisfying the desire will be pleasurable. And that's a good word to use here. It definitely is pleasurable. And therefore, you will always get pleasure. The key question is the pleasure the goal of the action, or was it get pleasure a byproduct of succeeding at the action?
And he's saying it has to be a...
No. That's not making that mistake either. But all Butler wants to show is that some of our motivations are altruistic. Not all of them. Just some. It doesn't have to be this way. Let's go back to the ice cream. When I buy vanilla ice cream, I eat vanilla ice cream, the whole thing is selfish. Because it starts with a basic pleasure. The basic pleasure then generates a desire for that basic pleasure. When I act on that desire, I'm doing it in order to get myself a basic pleasure. That's certainly selfish. No one's doubting that there are selfish desires, selfish motivations, and selfish actions. Where did we start 32 minutes ago? We started with the fact that people distinguish between selfish and altruistic. Some things are selfish and some things are altruistic. Both are correct. We're not taking away the selfish now. What we're doing is adding the altruistic to the bag of motivations that people have. Not all are what Butler describes. Butler's describing some. All you need is some. Right? The cynic says there are none. I would call him the realist, but that's prejudicial. Says there are some. Some motivations and some actions are indeed altruistic, yeah.
So the notion of a pleasure has to precede desire, right?
No, I've distinguished two types of pleasures. Let's go back over that. I said there are two different kinds of pleasures.
Right.
One pleasure, which I call basic, does precede desire.
Okay.
But there are pleasures of satisfaction, which by definition come after desire. A pleasure of satisfaction is precisely the pleasure of satisfying a desire.
Right.
That comes after desire, not before desire.
Right, okay, got it.
Okay?
Okay, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
What if, this idea of the extreme I understand, but what if you have, what if you expect to derive pleasure from a certain desire, but the result of that desire doesn't lead to pleasure?
You expect to derive pleasure from
desire. Like, let's say I expect to derive pleasure from eating, from a new restaurant that just opened. And I go to the restaurant, and my desire manifests itself in no pleasure because the food wasn't that any good.
So let me just ask you now. You're talking about a desire now, which is itself a desire for pleasure?
Yes.
So you really expect the two pleasures, right? You expected the basic pleasure plus the pleasure of satisfaction.
Right.
Now, the circumstances are that you were cheated out of both.
Right.
Now, what's your question?
My question is, I guess
so. In other words, yes, you can make a desperate mistake about these things, no question about it. But if I ask, what motivated you?
Well, the pleasure, the idea of pleasure, the end result of pleasure motivated me.
Yes, in this case, what motivated you was a desire.
Uh-huh.
And that was a desire for a basic pleasure.
Right.
So in this case, the motivation we would classify as selfish.
Okay.
But that's not typical of all cases. That's just true of this case. Butler's argument to say there are other cases where the desire that you act on, what we call your motivation, is not a desire for pleasure.
Right.
I haven't finished the argument. There are objections here, but this at least gets us off the ground. Yeah? Yeah.
Could there not be a third kind of pleasure that is the anticipation of the satisfaction?
Yes. Indeed, you don't even have to move to a different category. Once I have a desire for X, and that means that when I get X, it will satisfy that desire. You can have a desire for satisfying the first desire. And that gets you a double payoff also. Because then when you get X, you get a double satisfaction. But the second one, which is a desire for the pleasure of satisfying the first one, rides, dare I say, piggyback, on the first one. And the first one is often not a desire for pleasure.
But maybe the first satisfaction is in the desire itself.
Say again?
Maybe the first satisfaction is in the desire, that when you desire something that will get you satisfaction eventually, that fulfills a satisfaction in itself and gets you pleasure.
I don't hear how the words are working.
Oh.
I desire to win the chess game.
Yes.
And when I win the chess game, I'll get the pleasure of satisfying that desire. Now, what are we adding to the picture?
So we're adding that maybe there's another pleasure in that desiring to win that chess game is fulfilling a satisfaction in itself.
It's fulfilling a satisfaction.
Yeah.
To me, it's desires that get fulfilled, and that's a definition of satisfaction. I don't know what fulfilling a satisfaction means.
Well, the desiring itself is fulfilling a desire, fulfilling and producing a satisfaction.
The desire in is fulfilling. That might be. It's interesting. We have people come to the yeshiva and to take a look 50 feet from here, the guy who plays Medrash, first they're in shock. Those guys are sitting there 12 to 14 hours a day studying. They've got to be nuts. And then after a while, they're in awe. And one of the things they say is, I don't really want to study like that, but I wish I did. I wish I had that desire to study. Here's a person who wishes he had a certain desire. When he forms the desire to study, that formation of that desire might very well satisfy his wish to have such a desire. That may very well be. But what is he wishing for? He's wishing for a desire to study. So the desire is a desire to study. And that's what pushes him to study. And that is not a desire for pleasure. That's all Buckley wants to say. Yeah.
I'm wondering, most actions, even the most, the extremity cases of altruism, maybe they're subconscious. You're doing it subconsciously for actual pleasure. You know, you might be talking about a baby. But you've got a baby, and the baby's asleep. And your mind goes, you want to cover the baby. It may even be a good action, which you can think of in essence altruistic. Subconsciously, you may actually, there may be a subconscious reason for doing these things for your own personal pleasure.
I'm inclined to be sympathetic. We've discovered that the subconscious is a black area, and it's very difficult to know what's going on there. We do have at least some evidence in extreme cases that the subconscious is quite active. By the way, there's a Jewish description and theory of the subconscious as well. Joe Salanter had a theory worked out of at least part of how the subconscious works, and it's published in English if you want to know about it. But now I'm looking for evidence. You're asking if it's possible. I agree it's possible. I'm inclined to think that almost anything's possible. But if you ask me, is there evidence for this? No. There isn't, as far as I know, there's no evidence for this in normal people. You do have people who have psychoses or who have obsessive compulsive disorder and who do things and can't explain themselves why they're doing them and wish they didn't do them and hate themselves for doing them. But that's not the normal case. In the normal case, I don't think there's any reason for thinking that is true. But there's a more serious objection here, which I'm sort of hoping to hear. The objection that's made in the literature is, okay, there are desires for things other than pleasure. But maybe those things that are desired are only desired as means, not as ends. Maybe the only end desired is pleasure. And these things are desired because they are perceived by the person as means to pleasures. So, yes, we'll agree that there are desires for things other than pleasure. But since they're only desired as means, the ultimate motivation, which is what you desire as an end, what you desire for itself, will still be purely selfish. It will only be a pleasure, a desire for your own pleasure. Okay? That's the usual suggestion that's made at this point in the argument. Of course, this suggestion is only a maybe. Isn't it possible that? Well, as I told you a moment ago, I'm inclined to think that almost everything's possible. If mere possibility isn't a good reason for thinking it's true, I don't think anyone has ever argued in detail, sort of classified all human desires, put them into categories, and argued for each category that if it's not a desire for a pleasure, it's always a means for a pleasure, and showed how to make that connection in a convincing way for every possible category of human desires. I don't think anybody has ever even tried to argue that. It's raised just as a possibility. So I would say just raising this possibility is not a good reason to for the altruist to fold his cards. I think there's something, if we look into our own psychology, why we do things, and when we think to ourselves why we're doing things, where it ends, that often it ends in things which are not, at least on the face of them, desires for pleasure. Very often, the train of means to ends terminates in a self-conception. What kind of person do I want to be? Why are you giving money to charity anonymously? Because there are poor people out there who need it. Okay, the poor people out there who need it, what's it got to do with you? Why are you giving to the poor people out there who need it? Because that's who I am. I'm the person who helps. I'm the person who's generous. I'm the person who shares. That's the kind of person I am. This person has a picture of who he is or who he wants to be, who he values being. And if you ask him, well, why do you value being the kind of person who helps? He might have an answer, but he might not have an answer. I don't know. That's just the kind of person I am. That's how I see myself. And that's what I like. That's how I want to see myself. This won't hold true for everybody. Al Capone definitely would not fit that description. I don't think he gave charity for once in his lifetime. He'd rather shoot up an opponent than give charity. It's not a self-conception that everybody has. Some people have it. Other people have the self-conception of being strong, aggressive, ruthless, and successful. This guy won't give charity. He won't even feel the loss if he doesn't give charity. On the contrary, What he wants to be is feared and respected for his intelligence and diligence in getting his way. And therefore, he actually said to him, why are you so aggressive and why are you so ruthless? So, that's who I am. That's what I like to be. That's what I want to be. That's it. And he likes to be it because he wants to be it. Because if he didn't want to be it, he wouldn't like it at all. So I think that if we look at our psychology, again, without any axes to grind, and just ask, trace the person's motivations up the ladder, I think when you get to the top of the ladder, often it's not, for me, that's vanilla ice cream. It just makes me feel good. But rather, there's a conception, and the person wants to fit that conception. That's what he wants. And that then causes him, or motivates him, I should say, to look for ways to fulfill that conception.
Where does the initial desire come
from? This is a good question. Where does the initial desire come from? What's interesting is this. People always ask, where does the desire come from? But they don't ask where the pleasure comes from. Somehow, pleasure is a given without any need to investigate its basis or its conditions under which it arises. And desire is a mystery, and one wants to have some kind of explanation for the desire. But I think we have evidence that people are born with desires. A need you might think of as a very intense desire. A desire is something which, if it's satisfied, gives you pleasure, and if it's frustrated, gives you pain. A need is something which, if it's satisfied, gives you pleasure, and if it's frustrated, injures you and may kill you. Now, it has been shown in some studies that infants need physical affection. And if they don't get it, you can feed them, you can change them, you can keep the temperature appropriate, you can fit them with clothes that are very comfortable clothes, and they die. So it seems that, and they definitely desire it, as soon as they're able to do anything, they look for it. It seems that we are born with the capacity for certain pleasures, and we are born with certain desires, and then these things change and develop in ways that nobody really fully understands. Sometimes new desires come into existence, and sometimes new pleasures come into existence. It is possible to have a root, basic pleasure in listening to Bach. That probably sounds crazy to most of you, but I can testify that if you invest in coming to understand it, it can just be like vanilla ice cream. It's just enjoyable to listen. You get a charge out of listening to it. And so you can develop the capacity for new pleasures, and you can develop new desires. And this idea that all desires are desires for pleasure would be a very neat theory. I now can explain where all desires come from. But it simply isn't true. We're born with certain desires that have nothing to do with pleasure. And according to Butler's argument, our psychology is much more various than that. So even this is not a convincing reason to think that this idea that it's always a means to an end, and the only end that you desire is pleasure, it's raised only as a possibility that if you examine your psychology, it really doesn't look that way. Now, before I leave this, I want to point out one more consequence. It's a bit of a footnote, but I think it's important. People play with this idea of selfishness and egoism. Let's apply it for a moment to human relations. Let's imagine an egoist in a human relationship. He says everything he does is only for his own pleasure. That's all he's motivated by. That's the sum total of all his desires. What kind of relationship does such a person have? The other person is just a tool for his pleasure. Indeed, as everything is just a tool for his pleasure. It follows, unless he's psychologically or emotionally crippled in certain ways, that while he's enjoying this relationship, that is to say, getting the pleasure out of relating to this person, interacting with this person, he has one eye open for another possibility which might be better. Why should he sacrifice a possibility for greater pleasure? All he wants is pleasure. So there will be no inherent commitment in a relationship. But for many people, a relationship without commitment isn't a relationship. And although I think this affects women more than men, and evolutionary biologists will tell you why, if it were true, especially a woman, if she has a feeling that the man is casting his eye around while he's interacting with her, looking for another opportunity, he's going to find it very difficult to tolerate. So the man's alternative is, do it, but don't show that you're doing it. Which means that the relationship is based, on, from his side, on hiding part of himself. All of this means that the picture of a person who's interested only in his own pleasure is a picture that doesn't do justice to the reality of human relationships. In human relationships, this is not how it's experienced, it's not how the person feels, it's not how the person acts. Unless you had a very convincing theory of self-deception, this is not how we experience relationships with other people. We don't experience them as just tools for our own pleasure. So, I think that this is the philosophical basis, as far as I know it, for trusting that such a thing as altruism. Now, I'll tell you why I raised this. Because in Jewish sources, motivation for the commandments that you perform is important. I wouldn't say it's crucially important. More important is doing the action. Doing the action with the intention to satisfy the commandment. But you can classify the performance in terms of better and worse in terms of the motivation for doing the action. If a person performs a mitzvah for the sole purpose of getting reward in the world to come and avoiding punishment in this world, the world to come, he has satisfied the mitzvah and it's valid and he will be rewarded for it. But it is a very low motivation. It occurred to me, I've never played with this idea, but it occurred to me just yesterday that maybe desiring a reward in this world is even lower. Because it doesn't interact with the religious premise. Maybe, I have to think about it. But it's very low. We are told to try to serve God out of love. Serve God because of the importance of so doing for itself, not because of anything that we'll get for it. Now, if altruistic motivation were an impossibility, if altruistic motivation were just an illusion, then this prescription to try to serve God out of love and not for any selfish motivation would be absurd. It wouldn't connect with the reality of human psychology. So it's important to know that human psychology does have in it some altruistic motivation. Once you have some altruistic motivation, then you can undertake steps to strengthen. I believe, I can't prove this, but I believe that if a person is missing a whole category of motivation, I don't know how one would encourage him to act or behave so as to gain it. There are people who are called psychopaths. A psychopath is a person who has no perception of another person's pain. As pain. He doesn't perceive it as pain. Psychopath says, what do I do with this knife? I want to put it someplace where it will be out of the way. Well, I could stick it in the table, or I could stick it in his arm. True, sticking it in his arm is messy, you know, because that red stuff comes out. And it's noisy, because he howls. But I could take the howling. I have earplugs. So, and I'll clean up the mess later, you know, and it goes in easier, so I'll stick it in here. Right? That it's pain doesn't register. It just doesn't react to it. It's like he's got a blind spot, and that doesn't react to it. I don't know what could be done for such people. I'm inclined to think that if a person is missing a whole category of emotion or a whole category of motivation, it's very hard for you to imagine what you could do to induce it in him. It's like a cripple. But if you got it, then there are steps you can take to strengthen it. We know there are steps you can take to strengthen it. People who are capable of sympathy, capable of care, literature can be very valuable. Because literature describes the experiences that people have. You read a good portrayal of addiction, and you will never feel the same about an addict. And it would be terrible if you could only become sympathetic to addicts by becoming one. It's much better to read it in literature. And then it arouses your inherent sympathy, but it makes it more vivid and more focused because you vicariously have those experiences, and then it becomes more dominant in your personality. So you can take steps to strengthen your motivation if that category of motivation exists. If it doesn't exist, I think, I may be wrong here, but I'm inclined to think that it's hopeless. There's one last thing that I want to tell you. I got this wrong for years and years and years. And only a few years ago, I came to a conclusion of my own, and I was very happy to see that a prominent philosopher said it in a recent book. John Searle said it in a book that I've just been reading four times. So I was very happy to see it. The Rambam says in chapter 9 of the Laws of Repentance that everyone desires reward in the world to come. Everyone. Everyone. Prophets, sages, tzaddikim, righteous people, everyone desires reward in the world to come. That's what he says in chapter 9. Chapter 10, he says, what I told you before, that a person should try to develop into doing God's will for its own sake, out of love of God, without being motivated by reward in the world to come. Now, that struck me as a contradiction. I'm a person with a lot of desires. He tells me in chapter 9 that everyone has, or should have, this is the prophets and the sages, everyone should have a desire for reward in the world to come. The greatest Jews had a desire for reward in the world to come. If you tell me to develop, in addition, a desire for serving God for its own sake, without a reward in mind, and you picture the two desires side by side, I can understand that. And then when I serve God, I could be serving Him out of both desires. If you tell me to develop the second desire, serving God for its own sake, without the thought of reward, so that it would be strong enough, if it were alone, to move me to act, so that I don't have to lean on my desire for reward in the world to come to get me to act, I can understand that well. I can understand what it means to strengthen a desire. But to tell me that I have both desires side by side, and when I carry out the act, it satisfies both desires. I'm only doing it for one of them. It struck me as impossible to understand. What do you mean? The other one's there. It's getting satisfied. But the answer, I think, is this. This is what Searle says. A person can have several motivations for doing something, and he can choose to do it for one of the motivations and not for another. In the choice process, you don't only choose what to do, but you also choose why you're doing it. There are two pictures at war here. One picture is that desire is like the wind. And you're a cork on a placid pond, and the wind is blowing. And there's a breeze from the west, and a breeze from the east, and some whirlwinds, and they blow you, and then whichever way the strongest winds blow you, that's the way you go. If desires were like that, then the picture that I'm describing is impossible. I have two desires, and they both aimed at the same action, so then they're pushing me. And if they're pushing me, when I go, I'm going because they both pushed me. So if the picture is that motivation pushes you, then I don't know how to make sense out of the Rambam description. Searle's picture is different. Searle's picture is I make a choice. I'm faced with possibility of actions. I'm faced with a variety of motivations. I choose what to do, and I choose why to do it. He says this is a fact of common human experience. He gives the example of voting for a candidate. He said, what reasons did you have? What was relevant in your choice of this candidate? He said, well, listen, number one, he has good economic policy. And number two, he's in good health. And number three, we happen to go to college together, and I have a loyalty to all my old college chums. So really, so why did you do it? Tell you the truth, although I do desire good economic policy, and he has it, and I do think the president should be in good health, and he has good health, but really, the reason I did it was loyalty to my college chums. That's why I did it. Now, Searle says, this is a fact of common psychological life, at which we ought to be astonished. I know this without experimentation, and I know it without external testimony. I know from having performed the act why I performed it. I know what reason was the reason for which I performed the action, because I performed it. And I could say that the other wasn't why I did it. That's as far as Searle goes. I think you could even concoct a difference in practice. Let's suppose that I have two desires for the same action. Each desire has a certain motive strength, if you like, or a certain payoff. Let's say that they each have a payoff of 5. Let's suppose I have a competing action, which also has a desire, with a payoff of 7. Now, if I decide to do the first action because of both desires together, then I will succeed in the decision because the competition only has a payoff of 7. But if I decide that when I do this action, I only do it for one of the reasons, and I don't do it for the other reason, then when it's a competition of 7, it'll be 7 against 5, and I won't do it. So by deciding what my motivation shall be, I determine the strength of that particular action's grasp on my decision. And I can decide that. Once you look at it through Searle's eyes, what the Rambam says, and he was 900 years before Searle, just that it took Searle to wake me up to see that this, I figured it out a couple of years ago, but I was so happy to see that Searle said this. It took me a long time to see that one can decide to act on one desire and not to act on another desire, even though both desires are aimed at the same action. If so, then what the Rambam says can be taken kipshuto, can be taken very simply. You have both desires are natural and normal and appropriate, and you act on this one and not on that. Okay, that's introduction to answers. Yeah,
okay, just going back to what you said about relationships and stuff. I don't know if this is a true statement, but would you say that true love, whatever love is, has to have some element of altruism? Because often people say, I love someone, but really just it's the feeling that they give you.
Yeah, that's right. The wag says, you love chocolate, so why don't you protect it, put it in a case and guard it, lock it up. You eat it, that's how you show you love chocolate. No, you love eating chocolate, that's what you love. You don't love the chocolate. Now, I think that's right. I think, let's put it this way. Certain types of relationships and experiences call out in a person these kinds of responses almost without his desiring it or without his willing it or without his even being in control of it. You'll have children. You'll see your 6-year-old go up on the stage for a class performance, right? And your child's turn to speak, and the child forgets his life. You die. You die. Your stomach is sinking. Your stomach is sinking to the floor, and you break out in the cold sweat. The kid doesn't take it that way. He doesn't take it that way. He gets his line, just stands there for a bit, there's a teacher prompts him, and he goes ahead. He's not bothered by it. You're bothered by it. Why? It's my child, you know. Now, it's not true that, you know, forgetting his lines at age 6 is going to kill him for a shidduch, you know, when he's 20. It's not going to do that. No one's going to say to me, your child forgot his lines, you're a failure as a parent. What's going on here? I'm identifying with the child's experience and then experiencing it for myself. Right? So that's a kind of involvement with the other person, taking on the other person's identity, so to speak, and using what's happening to him to... it becomes a stimulus for your own response, which certainly is not motivated by gaining more pleasure. Yeah.
Well, what I want is just going back to the point you were saying before about the fact that someone can decide their motivation to do an action. I wonder whether that's actually, is the basis or is a fact. The fact is that I was once heard by someone, my father, who said that a wise man can justify things to himself.
What's that?
A wise man can justify things to himself. You convince yourself that in fact, my intentions of doing it because of that desire, but when in effect it's actually not. You're just you're naming it. That's the reason why I'm doing it. The method, it actually is not. It's actually the original base.
Yeah, well, see, again, I think you're right in raising this as a possibility. But raising it as a possibility doesn't give me any reason to think that it's the norm. Yes, there are people who rationalize, but then there are people who take very painful decisions on the basis of facing reality squarely and doing something about it. There are addicts who shut themselves up in asylums, which is a very painful decision because they know they have to do it. So he's not justifying anything to himself. On the contrary, he's facing the reality. So while it is possible, and also in cases like the one Searle describes, he's not justifying anything. In fact, he may say it with a certain embarrassment. I know that I ought to be I often make decisions on the basis of economic policy, but I haven't done this either because it's a drinking chum. So, you know, or a college chum. So it's not a case of justifying anything. It's just reporting. When I made the decision, this is what I this is what I was aiming at.
Yeah, but the thing is that what I debate is that the fact that he, although you say that's your motivation for doing that, when in fact it actually is, you could very easily say, by desire, you know, you can convince yourself in your mind, that's my desire to do that. I'm doing it for purely altruistic reasons. What in fact is actually not?
You're right, it's possible. But now what about the person who says, I know I did it for selfishness? But he says that, he's not justifying anything, not making himself any better. Indeed, he says, I know I did it for selfish reasons, and I have to work on myself not to be like that.
Yeah.
So there's no motivation here for creating a false picture. If you ask, could it still be false? Yes, it could. But do I have any evidence to think it really is false? I don't think so.
But yeah, you could explore that, even a person who's doing something for selfish reasons, if you explore their actual intentions, you know, there's an element of good in every evil and there's an element of every good. If you explore their actual intentions, you could find that actually there was maybe a different reason for doing something. They were maybe, righteous reasons for doing something, they could be doing something. And as I said, there's a level of your awareness of your own consciousness.
Well, I agree that there's limited control.
Yeah.
That is to say, some motions of human bodies are not chosen at all.
Yeah.
They're out of control. But surely that's not the norm. When you decide to get a cup of coffee, or you decide to make a phone call, or to read a book, or go to sleep, and get up early tomorrow morning, or vice versa, I mean, these are not actions that are experienced or appear to be compulsions.
Sure, our minds are very intelligent things. Sometimes we actually do something, and we're doing an action, but it's actually, you realise in retrospect, when you look back at the action, that it was actually, you know, there was other subconscious...
Freud was criticised for creating his psychological theories on the basis of treating people who were sick. And generalizing from a sample of sick people to the principles that govern all people, including the vast majority of healthy people. So I think that while in some cases you can find that, that's no reason to think that all cases are like that. That's all. I'm not denying that there are aberrations. No one is saying that one's self-consciousness is infallible. But to say that from the fact that I made some mistakes, you know, there are illusions. When you drive on a hot day on a tar road, you look down the road, it looks as if the road is wet. No one suggests that because there are illusions like that, that maybe every one of my visions of water is an illusion. You are subject to illusions under certain conditions, and you define them by experience, and the rest of them you don't say are maybe all illusions, because sometimes I'm shown to be subject to illusions. It's not presenting enough evidence to draw that kind of conclusion. Okay. Come on, folks.